Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that has influenced their own work in some small way. And, you know, for those of you guys who are listening now, we are social distancing, we're remote recording, I'm in my bedroom, chicken is sleeping, so you won't hear the cat, birds might be around, audio's just a little bit different, but, you know, most everything is the same, except for our guest today is the wonderful writer, director, actor, Lily Marier. Hi!
Hi, April! I'm so excited to be here. I'm a big fan of Switchblade Sisters. Thank you for inviting me.
We are a big fan of you.
Oh, and, my goodness.
And, you know, let us go back and explain to everyone why we're a fan of yours with a bio.
What a good segue.
I know. Born in Las Vegas, Nevada, Lily graduated from UCLA with a BA in theater arts and went on to appear in many films, such as Extraordinary Measures, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, Mighty Joe Young, The Shadow, The New Age, and The Doctor. She's guest starred in over 30 TV shows, including Murder in the First, Criminal Minds, NCIS LA, Shameless, and had a recurring character on Teen Wolf. But you may probably remember her best as Nurse Lily Jarvik on ER, a role she played for all 15 seasons of the show, an anchor, an emotional anchor for the show.
Oh, thanks. Yes. All right.
But around the year 2000, Lily took steps to move behind the camera, writing and directing the shorts Shangri-La Cafe, Air, and Thumbing It. Shangri-La Cafe alone played at 25 film festivals, gaining momentum for her to make her 2012 feature directorial debut, Model Minority, starring Nicole Bloom, who I love in the show Superstore, and
oh,
I was so happy
too.
To see in Model Minority.
Oh, good.
You know, you found her when she was kind of just starting. And
I was, yes. Yes. Whew. Yes.
It's a very different role for her, too, because it's a gritty and frank coming-of-age drama. That film became a launchpad for Lily's television directing career, and now she's directed episodes of Criminal Minds, NCIS Los Angeles, MacGyver, The Fosters, The Enemy Within, Nashville, How to Get Away with Murder, Prodigal Son, Stumptown, Just Add Magic, and The Terror, Infamy. Basically, she's making the rounds. She's doing the things. She's on TV.
I'm dipping into all the genres.
A Renaissance woman.
Aw, thanks.
So, Lily, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Truly, Madly, Deeply. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
When I first saw it, I saw it in an art house. And I just fell in love with it. I loved the writing, of course, Anthony Minghella. I loved Juliet Stevenson and Alan Rickman. And I just loved that it was a ghost story without being scary.
Yeah.
And that it it felt very... It felt very spiritual. It felt very, of course, it's very emotional.
Yeah.
And it just felt, it felt almost like a theater piece on film, which I think, you know, because he was a playwright and this was his first film.
Yeah.
I found all this out later, but, you know, it all made sense. And it just... It touched me in a way that even huge $300 million films often don't.
Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously it harkens back to the first thing you mentioned, Juliet Stevenson and Alan Rickman and,
yes.
you know, the technique of allowing these actors to kind of be and live in the space. And we'll get into all of that because the discussion on you know, how he made this film is so wonderful. But for those of you who haven't seen Truly, Madly, Deeply, today's episode will give you some spoilers, obviously. But that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Truly, Madly, Deeply right now, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Truly, Madly, Deeply. Written and directed by Anthony Minghella for release in 1991, Truly Madly Deeply stars Juliet Stevenson as Nina, an interpreter who's just moved into a new flat that's unfortunately infested with rats. She spends her days surrounded by jovial men who want to cheer her up and entertain her, including Titus, a Polish handyman who's one of many here to fix her rat and plumbing problems.
Nina, you are the only beautiful woman I meet in London.
Absolutely right. That's got nothing to do with the drink. I am the only beautiful woman in London.
Despite their best efforts, Nina is still deeply grieving the loss of her partner, Jamie, played by Alan Rickman. Nina goes to a therapist and talks about Jamie and her anger over his sudden tragic loss and how she hears him talking to her, reminding her to close the door, even speaking to her in Spanish. She just cannot let go.
I would have been feeling low, you know, very alone and hopeless, and then he's there, his presence. And it's okay, it's fine. And he tells me he loves me. And then he's not there anymore.
And then how do you feel?
Okay, fine. Well, I feel looked after, I suppose. Watched over.
Then one day, as Nina plays the piano, she imagines Jamie playing duet with her on his cello, but realizes it's not her imagination anymore. Jamie is actually there. And he's cold and grumpy. The two of them fall into familiar, loving rhythms, with Nina disappearing into her joy.
But dying. Actually dying. What's it like?
Dying's all right. It was a general anesthetic I didn't like.
No. I'm serious.
So am I. I don't know. Maybe I didn't die properly. Maybe that's why I can come back.
She returns to work a few days later, a happier woman, but that happiness soon begins to wear away. Jamie begins inviting some of his ghost pals over to the house without Nina's permission.
Listen, sweetheart, don't get... But some of the guys wanted to come back and just watch a couple of videos.
What guys?
Friends. Some friends.
Dead friends?
I don't know, I suppose so, yes.
You're telling me that there are dead people in my living room watching videos? Well, I mean, aren't these videos available wherever they are normally?
Look, if there's a problem, these are my friends, Nina. No, okay, I'll send them away, sure.
No, it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
I'd forgotten you could be like this.
Be like what?
Doesn't matter.
He turns up the thermostat, moves the furniture, even packs away a prized object Nina put out, which she never could have had out when Jamie was around. With Jamie's ghost friends around, playing music, watching movies on end, Nina finds comfort outside of the house, though, hanging with Mara, a single pregnant Argentine immigrant learning English. On one such outing, she meets a charismatic psychologist, Mark, who captures her attention. Nina even accepts a date with him, where they hop along the Thames and get to know one another.
Okay, no, this is what we do. I tell you everything about my life between here and that statue there. You see it? And then you tell me yours, okay? And we hop, of course. No lies from the speaker, no interruptions, no questions from the listener. And we're off. Mark Damien de Grunwald, 32 next birthday, born Budley Salterton. Capricorn, I don't believe in that, that's star signs I mean. Parents alive, retired, father silent, practically completely silent, 18 years older than my mother, who is not completely silent.
But she returns to Jamie, and it becomes more and more evident that they actually aren't a good match. After an emotional scene reciting a Pablo Neruda poem, Jamie agrees to leave.
Si tu no vives.
I know this poem. If you are not living.
Si tu, querida, amor mío, si tu te has muerto.
If you, beloved, my love, if you have died.
Todas las noches caerán en mi pecho.
All the leaves will fall on my breast.
Nina goes to Mark, and they go on a proper date. And when Nina comes home, Jamie is gone. As Nina leaves her home to embrace Mark, we see Jamie and his ghost friends stifling a tear, knowing his work is done, and that Nina will move on. And that's the end.
Wow. That was a beautiful description of the movie.
Thank you, Lily. I wanted to start this with talking about the idea that Anthony Minghella wrote this specifically for his actors. You know, yes. He had been working in the theater, and this is something that you had brought up before. Like, these are like, it's a company, essentially, you know, a theater troupe in that respect. And so, you know, he said, quote, "I'd written this for Juliet. She does speak Spanish, does sing and dance, and I wanted to exploit all of her skills. She actually plays the piano, too. She's an enormously generous and good human being, very smart and very funny, and I felt like a tailor writing the film for her. Mm-hmm. It was one of the simplest projects because it was a group of collaborators and a wonderful sense of family in making the film," end quote. And that's kind of the basis for this whole thing of him jumping into film, is that he's surrounded by these people that he knows, and he's writing these specific parts and catering towards their talents.
Right.
And I think that that's just such a wonderful thing, that when you are a writer director, you get to do that. Now, you have done both writing, directing, you know, with your movie, but then when it comes to TV, you can't necessarily do that. Like, you're still trying to maybe cater to your actor's strengths, but you can't do that. And I was hoping you could maybe help talk about that and address what that means and how great it is to be able to find someone who has these hidden talents you get to exploit.
Yes. I mean, I think that anytime I work with an actor, you know, if I'm in prep, I'm looking at the script over and over again, figuring out how I'm going to shoot it, you know, trying to think of transitions, trying to do all the things that a filmmaker does in prep. But I would say every single time I work with, or I've had the chance to work with a brilliant actor, he or she always brings something that I didn't imagine or couldn't imagine when, you know, once I get to the set. And it's that always excites me when I start shooting, to see that, you know, to see the difference between writing something for someone and knowing that they're gonna say it the way you heard it.
Yeah.
Or even if you, like, for instance, with Nicole Bloom, after I'd written this Model Minority and she came in to read for it, she read it the way I heard it in my head. And it's not very often that you hear that. And I always know when I find the right actor, because I start to tear up a little bit, even when I'm casting television. If the right actor comes in, I just have such a respect for acting that when someone comes in and they're bringing this script to life in a way that I didn't even hear when I read the script.
Yeah.
It just feels like you're connecting to the universe. I mean, it's overwhelming, that feeling. So even with television, you know, I try to do that when I'm casting guest stars. But I also feel like when I've had the chance to work with some amazing actors like Viola Davis or Martin Sheen, just that, you know, it's like someone once said to me, it's like playing a Stradivarius, isn't it? And it's like, yes, it's like, you know, you normally play this instrument, but now you've got this, you know, fantastically expensive, one of a kind piece in front of you. And it's playing in a way that you couldn't even imagine.
Well, I think, I mean, in this too, Anthony Minghella, he had said that when he was writing this, his writing was changing, how he was writing dialogue, his ear for dialogue was changing. And so it was just so special to have, first off, Juliet Stevenson be able to say those things. But he also said for Michael Malloy, who played Mark, he said, quote, "Michael has a perfect ear for fractured dialogue. At this time, I was absolutely obsessed with how writing dialogue for human beings to say for contemporary characters and you actually analyze their dialogue, there was no real syntax. Clauses and subclauses jam up against one another, sentences often unfinished. Ideas annihilate the previous idea in the middle of the sentence. My writing became increasingly hard to read, but then Michael hears it perfectly. And when it's done, you feel like it's being improvised. You train yourself as a writer never to write a sentence, end quote.
That's great.
And I think that's kind of getting at what you're talking about. It's just like you have these high hopes when you're writing something.
Yes.
And you're like, okay, well, maybe they can find it. And sometimes you might even audition an actor who like can't quite find it. And you're like, well, maybe I'm the problem, you know? And sometimes that's true.
It's not maybe, April. It's always, I think I'm the problem.
But when you find the actor who kind of like connects with your voice and hears dialogue in the same way that mm-hmm. you hear dialogue, mm-hmm. I think that that's have you had that experience as an actor too, of being like, oh, this is a person who writes for me in a way that I hear dialogue?
Yes, absolutely. I did a play called Tea in New York at the Manhattan Theater Club. Mm-hmm. And it was that same sort of thing where it sounded like me talking rather than dialogue that I was going to have to parse out and make sound natural and normal mm-hmm. and like something I hadn't planned to say. And I, you know, sometimes when I coach or even direct actors, you know, I think when we talk as human beings, we don't like sink into each emotion as we say the sentence. We like flit on each emotion and we mm-hmm. go. And it was something Anthony was saying, that we go from emotion to emotion to emotion to thought. And sometimes the thoughts interrupt each other. Mm-hmm. And that as an actor, as a writer, that's what you want to write. But as an actor, you have to do the same thing. You can't like sit selfishly in an emotion and then go to the next emotion. It has to be something that flows naturally and bounces off each other. The way your brain works, your brain has millions of synapses going on at once, and each one doesn't luxuriate as it comes in. It bangs off each other, and that's the way you have to deliver dialogue as an actor. And as a director, I have to try to help you as an actor find that.
Okay, well, try to help me. What would you say to me?
I would say you have all the right thoughts and emotions and feelings, but don't sit in them. Take each one and let it bounce off each other. Don't luxuriate in them. Go from one to the next to the next to the next. Trust yourself. I mm-hmm. see that you have all the right, you're doing all the right things. Trust yourself that you don't have to show me each one, mm-hmm. that it can go, that it can snap along.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's what I say when I'm trying to get you to go faster too.
Instead of saying go faster. You're like, if you could maybe flit along like a butterfly, like...
Right. Just trust yourself. You're doing it. You've got all the right thoughts and feelings. Just let them happen. You know, let them happen the way they naturally would happen.
I think we should say that in terms of trusting ourselves, there's a lot of great stuff in the commentary of Truly Madly Deeply about Anthony Minghella trusting himself that yes. he could figure some things out. There's one quote he said, quote, "I'm ashamed to say, and I believe this to be a magical thing rather than a failure. I knew this was a required scene in the film when they both confront that it would be better if he left at the end. I knew it would be translating the poem, and I didn't know what poem it would be. And then I went to my Neruda and I found within a page the section of the poem. I just knew that if I looked at it, it would be there. I've done that so much. If you're on the right track, I believe yes. everything will be waiting for you to use it," end quote.
Right.
You're like, she's sitting here nodding her head like, oh God,
I mean,
yes.
That's one of my favorite quotes of his, you know, and I feel like, I mean, I was so sad when he passed away because I always thought, I feel like a kindred spirit with him. I feel like he understood, and he works in the same way that I do, you know, that mm-hmm. he talks about being open and like witnessing everything you're writing or everything that's coming to you, mm-hmm. and that you just take it in and show it outwardly. And it's that same feeling of, yes, it's all there. You just, there's one of my acting teachers, Jack Plotnick, talks about the difference between any actor in the world and Meryl Streep. And it's not that her technique is that much better than yours. She has something that you don't, in that she doesn't block herself. Mm-hmm. She has learned how to just open the floodgates and be receptive to the thing that Anthony Mangella is talking about, mm-hmm. that everything's there for you. It's you who blocks yourself, and that if you can open up to see it, to witness it, to be there for it, that art and music and, you know, for him to have been a musician, he talks about that in his commentary. It wasn't a surprise that he can do many different things, that he can be that he is a musician, but that he is a writer and he is a director, that, you know, that he's just open to everything, and that it all, that he's able to just open the gates and let it in whatever form it comes to.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a lot more truly, madly, deeply. We'll be right back.
Schmanners. Noun. Definition. Rules of etiquette designed not to judge others, but rather to guide ourselves through everyday social situations.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband, host Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife, host Teresa McElroy.
Every week on Schmanners, we take a look at a topic that has to do with society or manners. We talk about the history of it. We take a look at how it applies to everyday life. And we take some of your questions. And sometimes we do a biography about a really cool person that had an impact on how we view etiquette. So join us every Friday and listen to Schmanners on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
Manners, schmanners. Get it?
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Lily Marier, and we are talking about Truly, Madly, Deeply. So, we talked about trust, and I want to talk a little bit more about trust in terms of being on set, trusting your collaborators, trusting that, you know, like there's a larger world for you. For Anthony, you know, we were talking about how he comes from a theater background, mm-hmm. and he wasn't completely aware of everything that you could use as a filmmaker, you know. He kind of criticizes himself when he looks at this film, sometimes talking about like, oh, it's just recording performances. But there was also, you know, a nice learning experience. You can kind of see that he points out shots in the commentary. It's like, this is the one I realized this. This is the one I realized this. Mm-hmm. But he said, quote, "I didn't trust any shot that was wide. It all looks so tight to me now, though. It's the joy of the film that relies on the actor's expressions. It wants to get in tighter and tighter. If I hadn't had some modulation from Remy, his cinematographer, I think it would all be a face, no body at all. Since I've gotten bolder as a filmmaker, it's what you can put in the frame, what you can see in the background of shots, using the various planes of view behind a body or a head. This movie is just recording performances, though, but they're wonderful performances. For many people, this is still the best piece of work I've ever done, so there's no correlation between skill and technique and experience. The work is some strange alchemy of the time and collaborators and idea, and the idea is a very strong one here. It's a true one, one that's come out of a genuine regard for a person at a particular time and place," end quote. So, I mean, he's got so much humility working on this first film and knowing that, like, he knows how to work with actors. He knows how to write. He already knows these things, but he has the humility about the other tools of a filmmaker, and then mm-hmm. it takes a little time. But, you know, he's so talented that he could get by on the other things and kind of learn a little bit as he went along. And I think that's funny because when I watch it now, I'm just like, oh, that's right. There are quite a few tight shots in this. There's like a lot of
I thought that too. There's another scene where he talks about it's where they're jumping on one foot. There were two things about that scene. He was saying, you know, the exposition is always difficult because, you know, you're just like vomiting facts out. And he made up this little game for them to hop on one foot and tell their story until they got to the tube stop. And then he did, I don't know if you heard him say that apparently, you know, the culty fans would wear t-shirts with their pictures on them and then hop on the South Bank, which was right in front of the National Theater there, up to the tube stop.
Which I love. I heard that and I was just like, that is so sweet for a film like this. I mean, like, it's not Harry Potter. No. It's a romantic drama ghost story, you know? Yes. It's like someone doing that for like the ghost in Mrs. Muir. Like planting a monkey puzzle tree for the ghost in Mrs. Muir. Like, that's such a weird thing.
It is a weird thing, but it's lovely. And it's lovely that he like doesn't think it's weird. He thinks it's sweet and it's wonderful. Yeah.
And he embraces it. And, yes. And I think there's but I think he is correct in that quote that you brought up too. Because he said, quote, one of the difficult things to write is exposition. It's an explanation of where they come from and who they are. And you're always trying to bury exposition. And I had the idea not to bury it and to make it a game.
Yes.
End quote. And that I think that that's an interesting thing because yes, as you know, writers, we do try to bury exposition. You do have to kind of like, hopefully maybe it's like in a mannerism or a piece of set design or something that can tell you about.
Or a little kid comes in and starts asking questions.
Exactly. And you're just, and it's like always contrived. No matter what we do, it just feels so contrived. And then he's like, you know what? Yeah, contrivance, sure. Lean into it. Like, it's a game. This is what it is. And he just, I appreciate that
Me
so
too.
Much.
And I love that scene. Also, he talks about how, you know, he said, if I were shooting it today with all the money that I would get for a film, it would take me 3 days to shoot it because I would want to shoot at exactly the same like portion of time. So the lighting was exactly right every day. Mm-hmm. But because he didn't have any money, he had to shoot the whole thing all in one day. And he said, if you look carefully, the top of the scene was about 11 a.m. So the lights one way, you know, looks one way. And by the time they got to the end of the scene, he said it was 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And they were like pulling up 1,000 lights to try to make it look like 11 a.m. But he said, when you look at it, you realize it doesn't. It doesn't look like 11 a.m. But he said, if people are, and I never noticed it. And he said, if the story's strong enough and the acting's strong enough and, and you're riveted on, I'm paraphrasing, but if you're riveted on what the characters are saying and doing, you won't notice all the things that as filmmakers, we go crazy about. Losing the light looks different behind her head now than it did back there. And if it's all those things that I think as a director, when I heard him say that, I thought that that actually gives me more confidence to make mistakes that stay in the film or the TV show and people don't really notice if the story's strong enough and your actors are strong enough.
You had mentioned before the idea that that story kind of gives you more confidence when you go on set. And I want to talk about confidence and projecting that, especially when you are a debut filmmaker and a feature because, and I'm sure you remember the story. I thought this was really heartening. The one that Anthony Minghella told about his first day shooting on set. He said, quote, the very first day of shooting, I drove my car to the set to the car park at Heathrow near to where we were shooting. The first AD then came onto set and said, whose car has all the doors in its trunk open? And I was so nervous that I'd taken all my bags and left everything open, completely abandoned. What hasn't changed is I will never approach any day of shooting without feeling nauseous and like I couldn't do it. I still get sick to my stomach seeing the campers and the people who have to work with you. I just remember the humiliation of having to go back and close all the doors, revealing how nervous I was. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring that up is because before we started recording, Lily rushed to put on some lipstick. And I yes. love that because we're like, oh, lipstick. You know, like we're not recording this. And what did you say? You said...
I said I started wearing... Like, I always have lipstick with me. And I started mm-hmm. doing it mostly because one of my mentors, Leslinka Glatter, always puts lipstick on. And she's very feminine and always said to me, you know, at one point I said, I'm going to be a director now. Do I have to be, like, macho? Do I have to be, like, present myself like a man on the set to, mm-hmm. you know, have authority? And she's like, absolutely not. You just show up as yourself. Mm-hmm. And then I read an article about Anne Fontaine, who had directed Coco before Chanel. And she said that lipstick always makes her feel like that's her, not so much her shield, but that it sort of gives her power on the set. Mm-hmm. And she even said what kind of lipstick she used.
Oh my god. Do you have it? Is that what you're holding up?
This, yes.
I love it.
And it's got a mirror in the mm-hmm. lipstick, and then you put it together like this. And I love it because it sort of looks like a weapon.
It does, yeah.
But I never forgot that. I thought, wow, you're right. You know, you're talking and people are looking at your mouth because you're talking.
Yeah, it's just like, look at my mouth,
here it is, and it's coming at you.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back to talk a little bit more truly, manly, deeply.
Hey, you've reached Dr. Game Show. Leave your message after the beep.
Hi, this is Sarah, and I'd like to tell you about Dr. Game Show. Dr. Game Show is a band of geniuses or nerds or brilliant artists or kids or some combination of all of those who get together to make a show like no other that's family friendly. It's an interactive call-in game show podcast. When I found Dr. Game Show, I found joy. I told my friends and family that if they weren't listening, they were wasting joy. I sent them the episodes that made me laugh until I cried, played it for them in the car. They laughed too, laughed their butts off, but they still don't listen on their own. So they're wasting joy. And I keep looking for someone to understand me. Maybe it's you. Give Dr. Game Show a listen and find joy.
Listen to Dr. Game Show on Maximum Fun. New episodes every other Wednesday.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Lily Marier, and we are talking about Truly, Madly, Deeply. So, you know, we've talked a lot about production, but I would love to talk about the fact that when you're shooting your first feature, it's so kind of daunting to not really know how it's going to show up in the edit room. And that was something that was kind of a bane of Minghella's existence of making this movie, because he just, you know, he didn't know.
Right.
And, you know, for him, it was about finding the rhythms of scenes. And for him, it was also about lack of coverage and not being able to find those things. So he said, quote, the scene, and this is specifically the scene where they're in like a laundry room and they are kind of like catching up and they're just like, you know, it's just like emotional. It's like right after they had, you know, come together. He said, quote, the scene has some very clever editing the editor had to constantly struggle with the lack of material. There's no coverage and there's a very unhappy cut of a two shot. The reason you have coverage in movies is because the rhythms you have when shooting is not the same when you're cutting. Perhaps an actor needs an enormous amount of time to generate a line, but in metabolizing the film, you want the scene to be faster or slower. If you can't go to another shot, you're forced to stay on the shot, which means you can't control the music of the scene. If you've only got two shots to choose from, you can only cut between them. If you only have one, you're locked into the rhythm of the day you shot it. End quote. I'm curious, you know, like, what's your experience with that of, you know, trying to find ways to alter the rhythm, maybe coming up against a roadblock or feeling like, oh, we've got it on the shoot day. And then being like, that doesn't actually work in terms of the whole piece globally.
Yes. I mean, really, my film school, other than AFI, was ER, the set of ER. And ER, because of our directors, had developed this style, and a lot of it was oneers with Steadicam, just one continuous shot for like four pages. And so to me, that didn't seem scary. That didn't seem, not doable. I would say in pretty much most everything I direct, I will have a Steadicam shot to take you from one thing to the other. It's sometimes in terms of rhythm, it works. And sometimes you've got too much shoe leather coming from one thing to the other, which sometimes doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But, especially with television, every second counts, every frame counts, because you're trying to cut to 42 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I'll shoot a oneer, and sometimes if I've got a showrunner who is giving me carte blanche, or if I got really lucky and this oneer is just fantastic, the whole thing will stay in.
Yeah.
Oftentimes I'll do a oneer and then I'll stop. And if I were making a film, I would just leave the oneer in. But with television, I will stop. I'll do the oneer as many times as I need to.
Yeah, and then, get your master. Yeah.
And that'll be my master. Yeah. And then I'll get tighter coverage. If in the oneer we've stopped to have a conversation, and then we go and we have another conversation, when I'm there and when I see it, I'll prep it thinking, well, maybe we have to do this two conversation, and then we'll have to do it when these three people talk. But mostly what happens is once I watch the rehearsals and once I watch the master oneer, then I'll say, okay, we need to cover this. We need to see inserts of the cup. We need to whatever it is, we'll need
whatever you need to draw attention to. Yeah.
Right. If I need to, I'll put it in. Usually I try to get away with it and not put it in my cut. And then when I see it on TV, I see that, they've added a few pieces of coverage. But usually they're pretty good about not messing with it too much. Because, a oneer in and of itself is beautiful to watch. And there's a rhythm to it that you don't want to cut into too much.
And speaking of that too, I think it's good to talk about transitions in scenes and how to really create some successful ones. Cause I think something that I thought really fascinating in that commentary track is that Minghella was talking about the fact that he didn't really understand transitions, because from a theater background, you're not really thinking about that necessarily. It's like performance carries to performance. You fade out, like there's like the light dims and then like the curtain comes, right? But for him, he was talking about there's a moment where Nina's in the backyard area and she's like hanging up the sheets.
Yes.
And there's just a really lovely transition where he realized when he was shooting, he said, quote, "The transition of the sheet to her face was the first time I understood that you could make lyrical transitions become devices. You have to have more time than I had to find those transitions, though. The flapping sheet is also a ghost, of course," end quote.
Yes.
And I think that's a lovely thing. And you can see sometimes the transitions in this movie are a little bit more rudimentary. You're like, well, here's a scene and then here's the other scene.
right.
But the times when he does do it, you know, like the sheet, I think he's there's a deliberateness to it that I find really elegant. You know, there's always something very elegant in the way that he's making these movies, but specifically these transitions. Right. And then later on, you know, you go and watch The English Patient and you're just like, transition, transition, transition. You know, like these are amazing things. You know?
Right, right. You know, I try to plan as many transitions as I can. And sometimes when I'm shooting, I see, oh, here's a good transition. But I always alert everyone. I don't just tell the DP. I tell everyone in the room, this is the end of act three and I need a good out. And I swear to God, by telling the whole room, everyone like gets excited. And they're like, how can we do this? What can we do? And it, you know, many brains are better than just my one little one. And I always find a great transition. And sometimes I'll have several transitions. Like, they'll be like, oh, we could transition off this. We could transition from him. We could transition. So everybody's working on a transition for me. And then I have an embarrassment of riches in editing. I'm like, oh, do I want that one? Do I want that one? But it's good. It also teaches me, because, you know, and Anthony Minghella talks about this, that no matter how, and I've heard other directors say this, no matter how many films you've directed, your crew has been doing their jobs longer than you. So they know, they just know more, and you really just have to lean on them. And so I've learned more. I've learned to lean on them as much as I can. And I always enlist everyone, because we're making this, we're doing this together. You know, this is a collaborative art, and I want everyone's thoughts. You know, one of my mentors said, if the craft service guy gives you a good idea, take it, because in the end, your name's on there and you'll get the credit. You'll get the blame if it doesn't work, but you'll also get the credit if it works. And it's up to you to see what's a good idea.
Yeah, and then when you go get a snack later on, you can be like, Todd, it didn't work. It did not work.
give me another idea, because that one didn't work.
Lily, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and selecting such a great film. Could you tell people, how could they watch Model Minority?
Model Minority is available on Amazon and about 10 different other platforms. You can find out on its Model Minority has a Facebook page. It's on like 12 different platforms, and
search it out on VOD.
Yes.
And any of the shows that you direct, they're all over the place. You know, maybe go take a look back at The Terror Infamy.
I directed episode 5 of The Terror Infamy.
You still have like a few episodes coming out of
my last two episodes I directed before the pandemic were Prodigal Son and Council of Dads.
Wonderful. So seek those out, look for Lily's name, and thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you, April. This was a joy. I really enjoyed this.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
I'd forgotten you could be like this.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.